Have you ever felt that pang of disappointment when you couldn't add a ticket to your collection because it was digital? Or maybe you just lost it? Well, StubForge.com is here to change that. Imagine this: tickets that not only look but feel like the real deal. Because each ticket from StubForge is printed on the same quality stock that Ticketmaster uses and printed with genuine ticket printers. It's like holding a piece of the concert, the game, or the show right in your hands. But StubForge isn't just about replacing tickets. With the easy-to-use interactive designer, you can create custom tickets for anything, from concerts to sports games, pregnancy announcements, or parties. Why not make your invitations stand out with tickets that are as unique as your event? And if you're trying to complete a back catalogue of missing tickets, StubForge offers bulk discounts to make it both easy and affordable. With StubForge, you can once more give your loved ones physical tickets and see their eyes light up instantly at the best gift you can give. So whether you're looking to reignite your ticket collection, craft the perfect gift, or send the coolest invites, head over to StubForge.com. Start creating today and see how StubForge makes every ticket a story worth saving. Visit StubForge.com and start making tickets today.
In today's episode, we'll be covering sensitive topics such as domestic abuse, child abuse, and violence. And if this isn't the right space for you to be listening, then feel free to pause this episode and move on to another one. In today's episode of the Bravery Academy, I'm joined by Eric Carter-Landon. This is one of the most heart-wrenching episodes of the Bravery Academy. Eric is going to share his story around losing his brother tragically 37 years ago when he was murdered. He's been fighting tirelessly for justice for Jacob. Eric has shared his story today to make sure that people are not silenced and they have ways of finding the help they need in those moments of crisis. Welcome, Eric, to the Bravery Academy. I'm thrilled to have you on here because I've heard so much about you from my sister, who has loved the work that you do. And I'm so grateful that you get to come in and share your story about your life and your upbringing and your fight for justice. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me on. It's an honor to be here, and I'm excited to have this conversation with you.
So tell me about where you are from and where do you live now?
Sure. I was originally born in a small town in New Mexico in the United States called Socorro, which in Spanish means help. It was named that because there were some, when the conquistadors were coming through, the natives really did help them and they fed them and clothed them. So that's kind of where that happened. Small town, I think there was about 6,000 people living there when I was growing up. And now I live in Albuquerque, which is the backdrop that you see behind me here, if you see this on video. And it's just about an hour, 75 miles north of my hometown.
And the story we're going to share today is around that upbringing for you. Tell me about Jacob.
Jacob was an amazing baby. I was raised in a very religious home, I guess is the best way I can say it. My dad was a Pentecostal evangelist, so he was traveling around preaching and trying to save people. My mom and I were often home alone. We were left pretty much without any support. My dad would go and then just kind of forget about us. But I really wanted a sibling. I was praying for a brother pretty much every night when I would say my prayers at night. And when I found out that my mom was pregnant, it was probably one of the happiest moments that I can remember from my childhood. I literally just for the first time ridden a bike without training wheels, and I had wrecked into a bush and I was crying, and my parents like kneeled around me and were making sure that I was okay. And then they decided that that was the moment that they wanted to tell me that my mom was pregnant. And so I forgot about the pain and about falling. And I started running around and screaming and like cheering and jumping up and down. And it was a very happy moment for me. I'm sure that my mom had mixed feelings about it because, you know, things were difficult in her relationship with my dad, and she had another kid to take care of. It made it really hard for her. Like, she was unable to work because she had two very young kids. And so eventually, after Jacob was born, my parents separated. It's about five when they separated. So this would have been the summer before I started kindergarten. My parents separated. My dad was having an emotional affair with another woman, and my mom just had it. So she decided she was going to move us back to New Mexico. We were living in Texas at the time, to live closer to my grandparents and her sisters so that she could work, because she needed that support system. So we packed everything up and we moved. Jacob was a crazy, crazy baby. I know that probably sounds weird, but he was fearless. You know, we didn't have him for very long in our family, but we did have very memorable moments with him. He loved to do things that were scary and dangerous. He had this baby swing that was like a wind-up baby swing from the 80s. It wasn't very safe to begin with, but it also, like, this was before childproofing. There was really no concern about any of that stuff in the 80s for some reason. But his favorite thing to do was, when he would swing forward, he would grab the front legs of the swing, and as it would swing backward, he would throw the whole thing back, and he would be lying on the ground, and then he would just be laughing his head off. He thought it was hilarious. We had to start putting the swing against the wall so that he couldn't do that anymore, because he kept wanting to do that. He liked to pull drawers out of the cabinets in the kitchen with knives and forks and everything flying around him. He thought that was hilarious.
An absolute adventurous. Yeah. At that time when you were at home in New Mexico, when you'd moved back there, what else was happening around that family life?
Yeah. A lot of interesting things started to happen. So we're living with my grandparents. My mom starts working at the local grocery store that my grandmother manages. And I enroll in school. Jacob is being watched either by my grandparents or my aunts. At the same time, this man who knows my mom very well, knows my family very well, his sister is married to my mom's brother, and he's my dad's best friend. So this person was not a stranger to my family. My mom went to school with him since she was a kid. They went to church together every weekend. They grew up together. You know, our families kind of commingled. So he starts coming around my mom, and he knows about everything that happened. He was somewhat involved in the conversation with my parents as my mom uncovered this emotional affair. And so I just say all of that because as we start to talk about this person, people can form opinions about situations without fully understanding the entire context behind everything.
Absolutely.
So I think it's important to know that this person was not a stranger. Mm-hmm. It's important to know that this person was thought well of in the community. This person was friends with law enforcement and with politicians in town, and was seen as a very friendly, outgoing, happy person. He starts to, what I now know as love bombing, he starts to love bomb my mom and I. He sees the situation, he knows what's going on, and so his immediate reaction is to start showering us with attention and with gifts. My mom is starting to be showered with affection, and he makes these big, grand, romantic gestures and, you know, gives her like a dozen roses and chocolates and just everything he can to woo her, to get her attention. At the time, it was really cool. At the time, I thought it was amazing. I got whatever I wanted. If I wanted candy for dinner, like, we would have candy for dinner. If I wanted to watch an R-rated movie with him, I was allowed to do that. If I wanted to listen to music with bad words, like, all of the things that a little boy would think was really cool without understanding, you know, what was really happening. So all of that seemed fine. But then things started happening to Jacob. Jacob started to get hurt. I think he was about 4 months old, maybe 5 months old at that point. He starts to get injured. He has a skull fracture that there ends up being like fluid building up And so he has to have surgery to have the fluid drained, and he has to wear a styrofoam helmet. And as all this stuff is happening, and I'm still about 5 years old, maybe 6 years old by this point, I start to be blamed for these injuries, these things that are happening to Jacob. And my mom's boyfriend starts to create this narrative about me that I am jealous of Jacob, and that every time I see Jacob, I hit him, or I pinch him, or I punch him, or I kick him. And he tells a story related to Jacob's head injury that I find hard to believe. I don't remember that this happened. I'm not saying that it's not possible that it happened. I just don't remember this occurring. So he claims that he went to drop his kids off one day and Jacob was fussy. So he decided to leave me, a six-year-old, alone with a six-month-old baby or a five-month-old baby, just real quick so he could drop off his kids to his ex-wife. And so if that story is true, he's very neglectful, not a great parental figure just from that perspective. But his claim was that Jacob was crying and I went to pick Jacob up out of the crib and I dropped Jacob on his head. There's a couple of reasons why I find that hard to believe. The first one is that I was a very small child. I was lucky if I weighed 40 pounds at that point. Jacob was a huge baby. He was 10 pounds when he was born. He was probably close to 20 pounds by this point. He was not a little kid. The crib itself probably would have come up to my chest as an adult. It was a very tall crib. It had wheels that you could roll it around. So it was kind of lifted up high. So in order for me to get Jacob out of that crib, I would have had to have grabbed a chair from the kitchen, probably pushed it up against the crib, and then tried to pick him up somehow. It could have happened, maybe. I don't know. I don't remember it happening, but that's what the story was.
And he wasn't there to see it either.
According to him.
Yeah.
If this even happened, right? Yep. I find it hard as a parent. Like, I would never leave a six-year-old in charge of an infant. I would never leave a six-year-old alone. So even if that is a true story, it says a lot about him. My mom was not sure what was going on. Like I said, she trusted this person. He was a trustworthy person by all accounts. If you asked anybody who knew him, they would say that about him. So she sends me to live with my dad. It was really confusing for me.
Hi there. I'm Heather Drago.
And I'm Sarah Saunders.
We host the podcast, That's a Hard No, about saying no and setting boundaries,
so you can become that true and empowered you that this world needs. Saying no isn't just okay.
It's the key to living an authentic, fulfilling life.
I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor, so while this podcast is in no way a replacement for one-on-one therapy, I suppose I know what I'm talking about.
I'd say so. We talk about learning to say no and set healthy boundaries and how it impacts mental health, physical health, relationships, parenthood, and more.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit our website, hardnopodcast.com.
We're here to help you find your no and say it unapologetically.
That's a hard no.
Our lives were never the same after we learned our 21-year-old daughter, Kristen, was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. It's a parent's worst nightmare. How much did we really know about domestic violence back then? Clearly not enough. Now we know plenty. We know domestic violence, or DV, can happen to anyone. One in three women suffer physical violence at the hands of intimate partners during their lifetimes. One in three. I'm Bill Mitchell, host of the When Dating Hurts podcast. And my interviews with DV counselors, law enforcement, and especially actual DV survivors give the pandemic of domestic violence the attention it deserves. The When Dating Hurts podcast. It's a series of lives being saved.
I'm being told by this person that I hate Jacob and that I'm jealous of Jacob and that I want to hurt Jacob. And I don't remember feeling like that about Jacob. I remember being jealous of his name. I remember thinking he had a better name than I did. And then my grandmother told me that my name meant princely. And then I was fine. I was like, okay, I'm good. My name's better than his. It's great. But I don't remember having this like anger towards him or this like desire to hurt him. So it was very confusing, but I was also excited to go back and see my dad. I was excited to spend time with my dad because I don't feel like we ever had that opportunity to get close because he was always working. I moved to California. I changed schools and Jacob continues to have injuries and his behavior changes. He starts to be afraid of things that he used to like. One day my grandmother was watching him and he loved to play Superman, which is like you just hold him up over your head and pretend like he's flying. And he thought it was the best thing ever. My grandmother went to do that with him and he started screaming and crying and clawing at her hair. And when my mom came home to pick him up, my grandma asked if like something was happening to Jacob because he was acting differently than he normally did. And when my mom asked her to explain what she was talking about, my grandmother picks Jacob up to show her, and Jacob is trying to jump out of my grandmother's hands into my mom's arms and he's screaming and crying. So my mom confronts her boyfriend and asks him in one of many times if he was doing something to hurt Jacob or to scare Jacob. And he said, no. He said, all I do is, and he picked Jacob up, is I pick him up like this. And Jacob is again trying to jump out of his arms, but he's screaming at the top of his lungs. And he's just horrified and terrified. And it's just so out of character. My mom says, don't ever play rough with my baby again. And then she really starts to limit how much time Jacob is spending alone with this person. Back then, we didn't know what we know now about child abuse and domestic violence and those types of personalities, that type of predatory personality that preys on somebody when they're most vulnerable to gain control over them. And there were signs, but they weren't obvious at the time. You know, there was a time where Jacob was really sick and crying, and my mom's boyfriend wanted to play his radio as loud as possible. And Jacob was trying to sleep, and my mom went and just turned the radio down, and he starts screaming at her and yelling at her and telling her that she's just like his ex-wife and that she's not allowed to touch his private stuff. You know, not even considering that there is a sick baby trying to sleep in the next room. And this is a mobile home. This is a trailer. There's not a lot of audio insulation in a home like that. So, you know, my mom, she set a boundary and tried really hard to make sure that Jacob was never alone with her boyfriend. And I didn't know any of this was happening because I was in California. But, you know, this is all kind of stuff that I learned later. So on April 9th, 1987, my grandmother has Jacob with her while my mom's at work. My mom was working 11 to 7 that day. Jacob had been fussy. He had an ear infection, and he also was having an allergic reaction to some medication that he was on. So he just wasn't feeling good. And my grandmother wanted to go to church. It was a Wednesday night. She had a Bible study or something, but she didn't want to bring Jacob. He had been fussy. She just didn't feel like it would be good for him. So she called my mom and was like, hey, I really want to go to this Bible study thing, but you know, Jacob's not feeling good. What do I do with him? My aunts were busy. Everybody was busy. So she's like, well, I guess you can take him to my boyfriend's house. I'm going to be there in like an hour anyway. So, you know, it shouldn't be that bad. It's only an hour. So my grandmother drops Jacob off. My mom immediately starts to have this like really bad feeling and starts to panic a little bit. So she asks her boss if she can leave early, and her boss says no. So she just tried to focus on work and tried to shake it off, but the whole time she felt like something bad was happening. And not even an hour into that time frame, my mom's boyfriend comes running into the grocery store in a panic, saying that Jacob is unconscious and not breathing. And at the same time, Jacob is in an ambulance that's just going down the road to the hospital. So my mom leaves work and goes to the hospital. My grandparents meet her there. And Jacob's injuries are so severe that he has to be airlifted to Albuquerque, which is 75 miles north of Socorro. My grandparents and my mom, and my mom's boyfriend all got in the car and drove the 75 miles to Albuquerque to get to the hospital. The entire time, her boyfriend is telling her that it was an accident, that he didn't do anything, that he didn't hurt Jacob. He was just talking nonstop. They get to the hospital and my mom's told that Jacob's injuries were so serious and his lungs were filling up with fluid and he had a subdural hematoma on his head and a skull fracture. And they couldn't wait for her to get there, so they signed off on him going into surgery. So the doctor just had to sign it and they started operating on Jacob to try to relieve some of the pressure in his brain. But he didn't make it. My mom's boyfriend. So the doctor found his behavior to be so strange that he actually wrote about it in Jacob's chart. One of the things he said was the first thing that, I'm just going to call him John, because yeah. I don't use his name. The doctor comes out to tell my mom that Jacob died in surgery. My mom runs away screaming and crying, which you would expect. And John tells the doctor, "This doesn't look good for me. This looks really bad for me. I can't believe this is happening to me." And the doctor thought that that was so bizarre. That was such a bizarre thing for him to say when confronted with the fact that his girlfriend's baby was killed or had died, that he actually wrote it down and told the police. He said that he was concerned because from what he saw in the CAT scan, the injury looked like it was about the size of the open palm of an adult male hand. You know, John continued to maintain his innocence. His story changed probably 6 times. The first time, he claimed that he was dubbing cassette tapes. And if you were born after 1992, you may not know what that means.
I know what that means.
Me too. You know, it was like music piracy before the internet. And so he was making a tape for his brother, according to him. And Jacob was being fussy, so he had given Jacob a teething biscuit. But then Jacob was still crying, so he was going to put him to bed. He picked him up, and then the tape clicked. And then he sat Jacob down on the couch so that he could switch the tapes over. So when the tape clicks, that means it's stopped. You got to switch it to the other side. According to him, as he turned around to change the tapes, Jacob fell off of the couch and his head hit the coffee table. And then Jacob's eyes were rolling in the back of his head and he was vomiting. He went to the neighbors, somehow says that he performed CPR on Jacob. I don't know if that's true or not. He said that he just started hitting Jacob on the back. And that was, I guess, how he was performing CPR. So that was his first story. His second story was that he was playing with Jacob by rubbing his beard between Jacob's legs for some reason. I don't know. And that Jacob lost his balance and John tried to catch him, but he overcorrected and then Jacob's head hit an armchair. The problem with both of these stories is that those two injuries would be considered more sharp force trauma. And Jacob's autopsy says that he died from blunt force trauma. So the doctor immediately said that those two scenarios were not possible and relayed that information to police as well. And then his story changed again and it changed again.
What were the police doing at this time?
The police started investigating. Because Jacob died in Albuquerque, even though he was injured in Socorro, it was a state police matter because it had crossed jurisdictions from county to county. So the state police were investigating. Socorro County and Socorro Police had their own investigation. And then they kind of came together and talked about it, the state police and the city and county police. Everybody was interviewed. My grandmother was interviewed. John was interviewed. My mom was interviewed. My dad and I flew back from California. We were both immediately interviewed as soon as we landed. I was taken into an interview room with a state police investigator and my dad at six. And I was questioned. I was asked if I was jealous of Jacob, if I wanted to hurt Jacob. I was asked if I had ever been hurt or if I'd ever been hit by John. I said, no, but he always acts like he's going to hit me. I don't remember saying that, but that's what it says in the record. So my mom stopped talking to John, but he was doing everything he could to talk to her. He would drive to her work. He would leave notes on her car. He would call her at work. He would leave notes for her boss to give to her. He would leave notes at my grandparents' house.
He's harassing her.
Yeah. And he told her that he wanted to tell her what really happened to Jacob, that he wanted to tell her the truth. And he wanted to meet her at Jacob's grave, which I don't know why, but she didn't go, thankfully. And then it was like summer, July, I think, 1987. The state police had ordered a polygraph for him, for John. And he tells my mom, like, okay, this is it. I'm going to prove to you that I'm telling you the truth. I'm going to pass this test. Then I want us to just move forward and be a family. So we go with him to Santa Fe. He takes his test. He's in there for hours. We're sitting outside in the car waiting for him. And he just comes out and says, everything went great. I passed. And so we leave. And my mom believed him because he walked out of the state police department. And, you know, in the 80s, I think it would have been a lot more telling, right? Like, you would have expected him to have been arrested if he failed that polygraph. So it made sense to my mom. Okay, he must be telling the truth. It must have been an accident. I believe him. He's not arrested. At the same time, after all this happens, he's like, oh, by the way, I enrolled you in my health insurance, you and Eric, and I claimed that you were my wife, and you're not, so I'm probably going to go to prison unless you marry me. They got married. I mean, at this point, she's believing him because he passed the polygraph, according to him. And he, at that point, like people who don't know this or don't understand domestic violence, they don't see that when things are good with somebody who is like that, they're like too good. It's like the movies, right? So there's like this romanticization of this person that happens. It's a mind game, really, is all it is. You start to question your own reality. You start to question your own truth. It's really hard to break out of that. And it's really hard to get out of that illusion that this person creates. So things got bad with them. He became very violent with my mom. It was to the point where she would miss work and she would miss family events because she was beaten up so badly that anybody that would have seen that would have called the police immediately. He strangled her. He wrapped a wire hanger around her neck. Anything could set him off. Sometimes nothing would set him off. He would just go off. And he became abusive to me, you know, emotionally, mentally, and sexually. And he told me that if I ever said anything about the sexual abuse to anybody, he would kill my mom and he would kill me and nobody would ever find us. So I didn't say anything.
You were silenced.
Yeah. I was just trying to survive. I was about 10 at this point. I used to sleep with a can of aerosol hairspray and a lighter under my pillow, kitchen knife, and a baseball bat under my bed. Just in case.
And nobody else saw it on the outside?
No, we weren't allowed to talk about it. I just kind of shut down. But he failed that lie detector test. He did fail, even though he says that he didn't. Eventually, my mom left him when she found out that he was grooming my 14-year-old cousin. her 13-year-old cousin at the time. He was trying to groom her so that he could abuse her. But she was not afraid of him. She was not afraid of anybody. She's still not afraid of anybody. She's kind of a loudmouth and doesn't care what anybody thinks about anything ever. And so he picked the wrong person because she just let him talk and she let him say everything that he wanted to say and promised not to say anything. And then as soon as she hung up, she called my mom and she called my grandmother and she told everybody that would listen. And my mom, I think, like, thought for a long time that she was the only one that was being abused. She didn't know
about
what
you.
Was happening to me. There's no way she could have known because it only happened when she wasn't around. But when she found out that my cousin was being targeted, that's when she realized. I think she felt in a lot of ways like she deserved what was happening to her because she blamed herself for what happened to Jacob. But yeah, we got out of there. My cousin, I think, saved our lives.
She did.
If it wasn't for her, I don't know that we would have been okay. When Jacob died, the police asked my mom if she thought John was capable of hurting Jacob on purpose. My mom said, I don't think so. And that's for all of the reasons that I mentioned earlier. Mm. They grew up together. They knew each other their whole lives. Our families are very connected. This was not a stranger. Everything she knew about him was good. And so at that point, she didn't think he was capable. But then 5 years later, when, you know, there's this trail of destruction from all of the things that he did, you know, to abuse both of us, her perspective changed. She now felt like he fully was capable. So she asked for the case to be reinvestigated and for charges to be brought, but they refused. The district attorney basically called her like a woman scorned and said that she was just trying to cause trouble for her poor husband because they're getting divorced.
Was domestic abuse acknowledged at that time? How was it treated?
It wasn't acknowledged at all. Like, I remember police would get called. The neighbors would hear. I mean, it was loud. You can't not hear what's going on. And yeah, the police would come. He played basketball with the police every weekend. So they would come. They would say, what happened? He would say, she's crazy. She attacked me. I'm just defending myself. Then they would all laugh and say, yeah, women are crazy. They'd get in their cars and they'd leave. So nobody took it seriously. When I reported my sexual abuse, nothing happened. I gave a statement to the police. They asked me very, very detailed questions about his genitalia. Nothing happened. Yeah. So, and the same thing happened with Jacob's case. Nothing happened.
How many years since she tried to open it?
Well, first that was 1991. Then again in 2005. In 2005, the state police reinvestigated it and said there was plenty of evidence to prove it. None of the reasons that John gave as to what happened to Jacob line up with what actually happened to Jacob. And at the very least, the state police said that there should have been a charge of criminal neglect. At the very least, because even if it was an accident, his neglect of Jacob is what led to that, you know, eventual thing, if it wasn't blatant abuse. But they could definitely prove neglect. They could definitely prove that. And so that investigator sent a letter to the district attorney and said, I think you can bring charges against this person. I think you can open this case. I think you can win this case. And the DA said no. At the time, there was a statute of limitations on second degree murder in New Mexico. And so that was the excuse that was given, but that was quickly overturned. And the Supreme Court of New Mexico actually has made that retroactive through another case. So Jacob's case actually could be tried now because there is no longer a statute of limitations and it is retroactive.
So there's an opportunity now, and this is a big part of what you've been working to have this justice. How much does it mean to you to have justice for Jacob?
You know, it's, I laugh not because I think it's funny, but I laugh because it's such a hard question. Because, like, what even is justice, right? Jacob's gone. You know, I mean, yes, it's about fighting for justice. Yes, it's about getting my day in court and getting Jacob's day in court, my mom's day in court. That's super important to us just from a principle level. right? Like the principle of it, like we should at least have had our day in court. For me, it's always been about making sure that this person can't hurt anybody else. And so I think it's critically important. I think the fact that he's been allowed to harm whoever he wants for the last 37 years is a travesty of our justice system. And I feel like the state of New Mexico is responsible for each and every single victim that he perpetrated against after this.
It was also silenced.
Yeah. Yeah. So the importance of it for me, again, like I said, is just making sure that nobody else gets hurt by this person. I, of course, want Jacob's day in court. I definitely want that. But the reality is, it's not going to be an easy case to bring forward. There's so much information missing. There's a confession that is mentioned in the police report that doesn't exist anywhere. Nobody knows where it is. And I've talked to the detective who administered that confession or who recorded that confession, and he said he definitely recorded it and he definitely wrote down notes and he definitely had him sign it. But none of those things are anywhere to be found right now.
How does that feel to you being let down by that system? Because this is what I'm hearing, is that there was nobody actually keeping you safe. That's what it comes down to, is a safety element for you and your mother. And there was nobody there to go, we've got you, you are going to be okay, when you are so vulnerable.
Yeah, there wasn't. There was no support. There were no resources. We were just ignored. And it was the worst feeling. It continues to be the worst feeling in the world, because this is the most traumatic thing that has ever happened to my family. And we're being gaslit by the authorities and being told that we're making a bigger deal out of this than it is. It makes you question your sanity. It makes you question everything that you believe. It creates this voice in your head that tells you, like, you're just being dramatic. You're just making a big deal out of nothing. And like, it's been impossible. It's been impossible. And this is why I continue to fight, not just for Jacob, but for anybody else who's out there trying to do this. This is the loneliest, most difficult thing I've ever done. And it's hard.
You keep doing it.
It's impossible. I keep doing it because I have to. I feel like I don't have a choice. I don't know. It's, you know, we got the case reopened by the Attorney General, and that's amazing, but it's been reopened for 3 years. And nothing's happening.
That waiting game must be, how do you feel about that? Like now, where you are at?
It's hard to find the balance of like when to start harassing people and when to back off. And then, you know, like, like where is that balance? And how far do I go? Like how much media coverage do I go after? And when is it too much? And also like, how do I protect my mental health while I'm doing all of this? And my mom's mental health. And it's just, it's a lot. It's a lot.
It's a fine line, isn't it? And my experience of what I went through, nothing in comparison to what you have been through. And I still felt the pain and the fear of coming forward and sharing my story. So I can't even imagine what it feels like to come up and keep saying, please listen, support. There's people out there that are going through it, but I honor you, Eric.
Yeah.
Because it's bravery. This is why your story means so much to share. And it's a big thing to come through this and go, doesn't mean I have it all together. This is, I remember telling my story and feeling like it was my therapy in many ways, of going, I don't want this person to hurt somebody else. And I don't know what they're capable of. And I don't know how to control this, but I'm going to find a way of letting my voice come through. And that's exactly what you're doing with True Consequences podcast. Can you tell me a bit more about that and why that's so important for you?
Yeah. So True Consequences is a love letter to Jacob.
Oh.
For a long time, I started to see cases coming through New Mexico. Child abuse cases. Child murder. And people would get upset and they would get angry and they would protest. But nothing changed. New Mexico has always failed child abuse victims, and they continue to fail. And I'm not the type of person that likes to complain about things, but I talk about this because I love my state. I love my state, and I love the people here, and they deserve better. The kids deserve better. And it's something that is hard to talk about. It's hard to talk about child abuse. It's uncomfortable. It's scary. It's hard to talk about domestic violence. It's uncomfortable and scary. I get it. But imagine what it feels like when you're going through that and you feel like nobody understands and nobody gets it and nobody cares. And that may not be true, but it feels like that because nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to listen to it. So I decided I was going to talk about it. As uncomfortable as it is for me, as uncomfortable as it is for me to tell all of my family's dirty secrets for the entire world to consume, I do it because you can't ignore this problem away. You have to face it head on. Because it's coming at us head on. You know, I did a talk at a podcast festival and I asked everyone to close their eyes. And I said, if you've ever experienced child abuse or domestic violence or domestic partnership abuse, raise your hand and keep your eyes closed. 2/3 of the room raised their hand. I said, okay, now keep your hands up. If anybody else who's here and your hands are down, raise your hand if you know somebody who has been affected by any of those things. And the entire room's hands were up.
We chose.
And so I asked everyone to put their hands down and they said, okay, now open your eyes. Every person in this room had their hand raised. So now I want to ask you, why can't we talk about this? We have to talk about it because if we create this idea of like that there's these monsters out there that are doing this, you know, that are strangers, it does nothing to prepare us for the actual perpetrator that is there waiting. Until we can honestly and openly address that and talk about what that looks like and how it happens and how easy it is to get sucked into it, that's the only way we can combat it. You have to understand what's going on.
So it's education. It's one big piece that I'm hearing. And the big piece, and this is why I know you do this work as well, is finding the voice for the voiceless in many ways. And as a child going through that, you don't have a voice. You don't have the tools, resources. And when we're talking about it now, and I can imagine that room as well, that when we talk about that sexual abuse, domestic abuse, violence for children, the way that we all go and hold our breath and we don't want to go there. And it's like, actually, we have to have bravery and courage to have these conversations and go, how do we actually deal with this in a holistic society to actually nurture and support? Because there is a missing links along this chain that aren't helping us. And we know it happens. So that's one piece is like, how do we stop the root cause? And then we go, but how do we heal? And this is part of it where I want to hear from you is everyone's going to have a different journey from this. It's like, how do we go from that experience of your life, your story, to being this beautiful human that you are now, a father, a husband, working, telling stories, to be brave enough to do that. How do you go from that?
Oh, man. You know, it's a balance. It's not easy. What keeps me going is my desire to make sure that nobody else feels the sense of loneliness and the sense of abandonment that my mom and I felt with Jacob's case. And so I created a nonprofit that's going to help families that are fighting for justice or searching for their missing loved ones, give them resources, give them referrals to organizations that can help them and educate them on the things that they can do to fight for justice. You know, I'm like, I keep seeing how much more I can do.
You know, but you only have so much bandwidth as well though, right?
Yeah, I'm even starting a conference that's going to help families that are fighting for justice too. So like, there's a lot, but there's so much work to be done. And there's so many opportunities to do good. There's so many opportunities to use true crime for good. True crime can help it can be a positive force in the lives of people that are left behind. You know, we don't have to settle for it being the way that it is now and the way that it always has been. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's good the way that it is.
That's what I like around the ethical way that you deal with this, because I know there's a lot of dramatization. There's a lot of ways of looking at true crime and podcast world. And obviously I've been in that world slightly from afar, but my sister has been diving deep into true cons and all of the elements of it. And actually, when we look at it, there's an ethical way that we need to be dealing with this so that the lessons that come out of it, and it's been the biggest reason why I did Coin the Con podcast myself, was it was like the lessons. I have been through a very traumatic experience in my life, and I wanted to make sure that I've learned from it and others can learn from it. And then there needs to be a different way going forward. And I can see that you have done a very similar mindset around, I can't change what happened. I can't bring Jacob back. Mm. I can't even have that time again. So I have to look at what is the way that I take control over this and create moments of good out of it. And you're doing that. The nonprofit, can you tell me what the name of that is?
Yeah, it's Angels Voices Silenced No More.
Beautiful.
And yeah, and we help families in New Mexico that are out there fighting for justice.
How was your mom?
My mom, you know, she's got severe PTSD. She's disabled, but she is doing what she can. She's on the board of a nonprofit, and you know, we're still fighting for Jacob. She's very involved in that process. She's just an amazing, amazing woman. She's so strong, so incredible, and has the biggest heart of anybody that I've ever met. And, you know, she refuses to be broken, which is admirable.
Brave. I could talk to you for hours. I know that. I'm so grateful, Eric, for your bravery every day to share the stories, to show up, and to actually take care of yourself. I'm sorry for the experiences. I feel very blessed that you've been able to share Jacob with me, and that I know that others that are listening today will have this moment of reflection and know that his story does live on and that he will have this ripple effect out.
Thank you.
If anybody wants to know more about the podcast,
True Consequences Pod on Facebook and Instagram, and True Cons Pod on Twitter or X.
And the nonprofit again, just so we make sure that everybody that wants to learn more about that, if they want to be able to start bringing this into other areas, into other communities, other countries, tell us again the name.
It's Angels Voices Silenced No More. And you can find out more information at angelsvoicesnm.org.
Can I ask you what you think bravery is?
You know, when I was a kid, I used to think that it meant not being afraid. As I've grown and as I've experienced life and as I've done a lot of really hard things and faced a lot of impossible mountains, I think bravery is what you do in spite of being afraid.
Thank you for tuning into the Bravery Academy. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button. And if you're looking to take your support for the podcast to the next level, visit patreon.com/thebraveryacademy to access exclusive content and get early access to our upcoming episodes. Your feedback means the world to us. So please take a moment to give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for being part of the Bravery Academy community. Stay brave, stay curious, and keep challenging yourself to grow. Until next time.